Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, Dad.
Yeah, Logan.
Why did the mama grape leave her family?
I don't know.
Because she was tired of raising kids.
No. No. You go right to your room.
But I'm already there.
Grounded.
You're listening to The Wayward Willis with John and Logan, where two atheists discuss religion, culture, and maybe some politics. If you're offended by blasphemy, profanity, or you hate fun, this podcast may not be right for you. And now, on to the show.
Hey, you.
It's us.
Or is it?
I'm your vaguely defined host, John.
And I'm Logan, recording this podcast from my deathbed.
You won't really benefit from the time you spend listening to this episode until after you die, but trust me, it's gonna be worth it.
Or at least that's what the coffin manufacturers will tell you.
We're talking about heavenly treasures.
So, what even are heavenly treasures?
Well, if you do a Google search for heavenly treasures, you'll get ads for jewelry, obscure porn sites, and Pastor Bobby Schuller's Hour of Power website. So, basically, the dictionary told me to go fuck myself.
Hey, that's my job.
Oops, my B. But after you've bought a lovely bracelet and jerked off, you'll find out that heavenly treasures refers to the promise of rewards in the afterlife. These rewards can be anything from a gigantic sprawling mansion to a ridiculous number of raisins to something as simple as a seat at the head of the table.
Or the long sought after approval of your stoic father.
Is that a reference to something? I don't get it.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Oh, okay. There are only a handful of places in the Bible and Quran that allude to what your experience in heaven will be like, so most of the doctrine among religious people is just made up, kind of like the religions themselves, but let's not jump too far ahead.
Whew, good, because jumping is not something I'm great at.
Well, yeah, because you're white. If there's one thing I learned from Spike Lee...
Hey, stop. No more.
Okay. In a single sentence, heaven can be summed up as the conceptual utopia on a spiritual plane where human souls go when their bodies die. Your admission into the various heavens of the various religions depends on a number of factors, like how well you behaved during your life, how charitable you were to others, and whether you worshipped your god so hard you pooped your pants.
Well, that was a disgusting callback with no context.
Yeah. Once you get into heaven, there seems to be a caste system in how great your afterlife will be. Kind of like how there are different circles of hell with varying degrees of awfulness.
The first one is just a middle seat on an airplane constantly in turbulence between two really stinky fat people with a kid behind you who keeps kicking your seat throughout the entire flight and a baby somewhere that won't stop crying.
Or, as it's more commonly known, Delta Airlines.
Finish him!
When you take into account the lifestyles of people in the Middle East during the time holy books were being written, the concept of heavenly treasure makes a lot of sense. When you live in a desert in tribes that seem to always be warring over the same plots of sand, your chances of becoming the Koch brothers are infinitesimal.
Is that pretty high up there on your list of aspirations, becoming a Koch brother?
I want Koch brother amounts of money, but I guess I could just cash this check from George Soros.
Wow.
Impoverished people don't want to hear that if they grovel to a jealous deity their whole lives, they'll get to be poor shepherds for eternity.
Unless you're like me and you have a weird obsession with farming.
Yeah, that's actually true. These people look up at the kings and tribal leaders and think, huh, I'd like to live like that. So, as these stories were being written, the authors incorporated drastic class changes into the script. You're poor now? Don't worry about it. You'll be a prince in heaven. You take orders now? Don't worry about it. You'll be the one giving orders in heaven. You have a tiny penis now? Don't worry about it. You're gonna be packing some motherfucking heat in heaven.
Yeah, but that only gets you so far. There's a bell curve. You reach a point where your dick stops being oppressive and starts being horrifying, and then nobody will want to sleep with you because they're afraid you're going to rip them apart. Not that I have any first-hand knowledge on the subject.
You know, you should have advertised that before you got a girlfriend. He is off the market, ladies. Biblical references are few and fairly vague, but that doesn't stop Christians from constructing an elaborate fanfic paradise out of it. When I was a Christian, I believed that when I died, I would have my own mansion on a well-groomed street made of pure gold next to all of my Christian family and friends, with a smugly satisfying view of hell where the horrible sinners are burning and screaming.
That just sounds like a depressing view.
Not if you're a sadistic Christian whose only concern is being right about Jesus.
Somebody needs to call the homeowners association.
I didn't believe this was figurative or conceptual. I believed in a literal mansion on a literal golden street. I wasn't a shepherd in a desert, but living in a lower middle class family, I was attracted to the idea of an abundance of riches forever.
Weird. I have no idea why anyone would want abundant riches.
I know, right? Jesus told everyone that they shouldn't try to amass wealth here on earth because what God was going to give them in the afterlife was so much better.
It's basically just like bottomless shrimp night at Red Lobster, only every night.
No, that's pretty much a hell for me.
It was also a hell for me when I worked there. Oh, bottomless shrimp night.
In Matthew, he says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also."
That totally sounds like a hint to find a pirate's treasure. Let me go grab my shovel real quick.
Yeah. What he's saying is that capitalism is a joke and we should eat the rich. That's what I heard anyway.
A fair assessment.
But the main point is that the less you have during life, the more you'll have in the afterlife. The more good you do here on earth, the more gooder things will be for you in heaven. God's got your back, fam.
More gooder? You're fired.
Your face is fired. Burn?
No.
Ah. Okay. Nobody really knows what these treasures and rewards actually are. Sometimes people will posit rewards of a silly nature, like superpowers. Many children will think that if you're good and go to heaven, you'll be able to fly or slide down an elephant's trunk or murder 500,000 hamsters without consequences.
Hashtag goals.
Oh, okay. Well, the hamster one was something I just made up, but it's not really that different from what they're doing. I mean, I'm not sure how or why these elephants are in heaven, but as long as they're making shit up, they may as well go all out, right?
I mean, one creature's heaven is another creature's hell, am I right? I imagine that you could save a lot of time and effort if you put doggy heaven in the same place that you put cat hell.
Oh my god, that makes a lot of sense.
This is millennial streamlining here.
Nice. So, yeah, I mean, I envision some dude hoping for x-ray vision in heaven, and then getting there only to find out that nobody wears clothes anyway. It's like hoping a fortune cookie fortune is gonna come true, dummy.
Dude, what is it with you and fortune cookies? That's the wrong kind of fortune, dude.
Well, I mean, you could make a fortune by owning a fortune cookie factory. Okay. So, back to the biblical references. Jesus says in the book of John that in his Father's kingdom there are many homes, sometimes interpreted as mansions, because why not? And he was going there to prepare one for you.
Aw, just for me? How sweet of him.
No, I mean, not you, because you've always been a dirty atheist, but the Christians.
Rude.
If you're wondering where he mentions streets of gold, just sit tight. We might eventually probably get to that, maybe.
Spoiler alert, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
What did I tell you about spoilers? Go to your room.
Rude.
In the book of Revelation, the author says that when all is said and done, God will live among his people and do away with sadness so that everyone is happy all the time and nobody stubs their little toes.
Is the implication there that we'll still stub our big toes?
Good point. Yahweh might be like a leprechaun where he gives you your wish but completely screws you over in a different way.
I believe it.
There will be no more death forever and we'll all just get along. Presumably, this is because the rules he laid out for living on Earth as humans won't apply anymore, and the spiritual kingdom has all new rules.
Duh, spirits can do whatever they want.
Right, like, or no rules, like Outback.
I'd like to acquire the addresses of the Outback locations you've been attending.
That's a secret.
But I need them.
No, first rule of Outback is there are no rules. Shit.
I'm so confused.
Christians view this as the most perfect state of the universe for them, but I can't help but feel it's pretty short-sighted. Our emotions, hardships, failures, and victories make us who we are. They teach us lessons, strengthen us, and make us better. or at least make us human.
Or in the case of Emma Watson, superhuman.
Okay, we get it. You want to crawl inside Emma Watson and wear her like a leotard. Jeez.
Oh my god, yes.
Sometimes those lessons are never learned, even when your stomach hurts so bad from eating an entire pizza, which you know you shouldn't have done, but you're still so proud of yourself for the accomplishment, and you're willing to take your wins any way you can get them. But that's really not what we're talking about.
Would you really call that a win? Because I would call that a loss on all counts.
One man's win is another man's loss. Hashtag deep thoughts by John.
All right, we're done here.
The problem with this no sorrow scenario is that it turns us into mindless joy zombies.
Dude, this is the moment I've been waiting for my whole life. I'm a zombie slaying machine waiting to be activated.
The Christian's view of humanity is all about free will. But if you're guaranteed an existence with no sorrow, then I have to presume that means you're no longer making choices.
At least not fun ones.
Fact. Also, Christians believe that some of their family and friends will end up in hell or obliterated, and if there's no sorrow in heaven, that means you've necessarily forgotten all about these people, as though they never existed. I mean, what kind of monster would be chilling in paradise with a mojito, not caring that the people they loved are burning in a lake of fire or poofed out of existence completely?
Well, depending on how many mojitos they had, they might just not remember them.
You're a thinker.
True.
But this is all bullshit. But think about where it comes from. People don't enjoy being sad, generally speaking. So if you're trying to concoct the most perfect existence, you'd naturally say that it doesn't include sadness. But that's a very childish way of looking at existence. I just don't buy it.
Probably because you can't afford it because you've invested all your stock in a fortune cookie manufacturer.
Someday that is going to pay off.
Yeah, someday, quote unquote.
Now, you may still be noticing that we haven't found a verse that says anything about what your rewards in heaven actually truly are. You're very astute. I like that about you.
Aw, thanks.
Not you. I was talking to the listeners.
Fucking rude.
Yeah, I broke the fourth wall.
Deadpool did it better.
I did it second.
Oh, wow. Is that something to be proud of?
Yeah, I don't know.
You're fine.
Okay. Well, what would you say if I told you that there was a verse that laid it all out? Black and white, clear as crystal.
I would say that I'm getting my hopes up.
Don't get your hopes up.
Oh.
Paul says in 1 Corinthians, or as the best Christians, the most tremendous Christians would say, 1 Corinthian.
Too soon.
That no eye has seen, no ear has heard, and no mind has conceived how great the reward of heaven is. Très spécifique.
Stop it. This is America. We speak English. If you want to live here, learn it.
My bad. This is just Paul shrugging his shoulders and saying, I don't know, dude. It's like really awesome. Just let your imagination run wild.
Good enough for me.
So as a Christian, you end up thinking that you get whatever you want if you're good enough to go to heaven. Ice cream volcano? Sure.
That sounds pleasantly painful.
Ocean of strippers? Dive right in.
Oddly enough, that sounds even more painful.
Pants that actually fit properly when you sit down instead of bunching up in the front and making it look like you have an embarrassing public erection?
Now we're talking.
Right. There isn't a whole lot of detail from any other verses in the Bible as to what your rewards will be, so you end up relying on denominational doctrine and whatever the hell your pastor says on Sunday. What's funny in contrast is that all religions get very specific about your punishments in hell, and you can probably guess why.
Because they read too much 50 Shades of Grey?
Maybe? But I was thinking, if you want the sheeple to fall in line and do what your book says, you have to have some really scary shit to convince them not to stray. This is the authoritarianism of religion.
It's also the basis of positive punishment, a thing I'm learning more about thanks to my dog trainer girlfriend.
Okay. So you show them the stick you're going to beat them with if they're bad, but you only hint at the trip to the water park they'll get if they're good. Like, okay, Timmy, if you behave while we're at the store, maybe mommy will get you a toy.
Maybe. The fuck out of here with that shit.
So the Streets of Gold thing is a real, actual thing I encountered while I was a Christian. Somewhere along the line, someone said that the streets in heaven, and I don't know why they'd need streets if you can fucking fly, will be paved with the purest gold.
Did everyone want to be blinded when the sun came up? Wait, is there even a sun in heaven?
Jesus is God's son.
Fuck you. Fuck you.
So they're talking about gold so pure, I was told, that it would be translucent. This is very silly on multiple levels, but people believe it.
You know what else is silly on multiple levels? A clown on an escalator.
Fuck you. Go away. So, in fact, my dad was so convinced. He once argued with me that he knows this is true, because they've managed to purify gold to the point where it's translucent for use on things like the Capitol Dome in Iowa or some shit. This conversation happened a long time ago, so I've lost the specifics, but he's not completely wrong about see-through gold.
What's that? I couldn't hear your admission because it was layered under 7 tons of salt.
No, just wait for it. So, NASA has been using gold-coated mylar on satellites and equipment for a long time. Most people think astronauts' helmet visors are see-through gold, but that's a common mistake. They're actually Kapton, which looks a lot like gold, but isn't, even a little bit.
Well, everything is at least a little bit like everything else. All the elements are just a few valence electrons away from one another, you know?
Yeah, okay. I'll give you that. But these presumptions that humans can refine something to match presuppositions about heaven are unfortunate and sad, but they perpetuate belief in things for people with limited imagination. I mean, really, if I were imagining a crazy awesome heaven, it wouldn't look like anything around this dump.
Why are you recording in a dump? We really need a studio.
You are not wrong. Muslims don't get much more creative than that either, sadly. They're more specific, just not more creative. In Islam, they don't refer to this place in the afterlife as heaven. It's simply called paradise.
But is it at an all-inclusive resort?
I don't know. Unlike Christianity, where all the good people go to the same place the same way, there's a tiered prestiging system for Muslims. The base reward tier is a beautiful garden paradise with multiple types of rivers.
A sick garden? Count me the fuck in.
And before you ask, chocolate is not one of those types of rivers, and there are no Oompa Loompas.
Dude, I don't give a fuck about that. I'm ready to farm some goddamn corn, bitches!
Whatever makes you happy, honey. The rivers that flow through paradise contain the purest, cleanest water, delicious milk, clarified honey, and the bestest wine. Though, since drinking alcohol is strictly haram in this life, I feel like Allah could get the shittiest, cheapest boxed wine and nobody would even know the difference, right?
I know I sure as hell don't.
The idea behind the river of wine is that in the afterlife, you're rewarded for the things you abstained from in life. Like clean water, I guess?
Oh shit, fucking roasted, Flint, Michigan style.
Ooh. Oh, too soon.
Oh, sorry, might be.
The next tier of rewards involves sexy time.
Bow. Bow, bow, bow.
The very pious Muslims will be in an even lusher garden with all the food and drink you could ever want, as well as approximately 72 virgins. Now, I say approximately because there's a dispute over whether an exact number is ever mentioned, and I'm no scholar.
Well, that's the smartest thing I've heard you admit all week.
Hey, I'm not above admitting my faults. I just don't really do it.
Okay, then.
The basic idea is that you'll be married to all these shapely, beautiful virgins forever, and you'll get to fuck every single one of them every single day. Then, every night, they all magically become virgins again, and you get to fuck them all for the first time again the next day. Lather, rinse, repeat.
Are sexual organs ever mentioned? Like, what if these are all virgins with penises? I feel like there would be a lot of homophobic creeps that would be super disappointed in their virgins.
You might or might not be surprised at how true that is. Abrahamic religions are the worst for homophobia.
Wait, like, they're the worst for homophobes, or they are really homophobic?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
No, that seems paradoxical. How can you have a bunch of penises and also be mad about penises?
I don't know. You're going to have to ask them.
Let me just go talk to Abraham.
I mean, I don't get mad about penises.
I mean, I've got one attached to me. It'd be weird if I got mad about penises.
Yeah. I mean, I stare at a penis every day. So the question is, does this get boring after like a bajillion years? I don't know, and I don't plan to find out. You're promised a giant cock that never goes soft, with orgasms that, if you experienced them during life, would make you pass the fuck out.
I feel like this is most orgasms for most guys, though. Shoop! Time for bed.
Ayo! This is a paradise concocted by a sad, lonely incel, for sure. The funny thing about this interpretation of paradise is that the words Muhammad used to describe the virgins literally translates to white grapes.
Oh, fuck yeah, man. Give me some of those grapes.
Fundamentalist Muslims will tell you it says you get virgin women with wide, lovely eyes. Scholars, however, will tell you that you actually get dark-eyed huri, chaste as hidden pearls, and that the root word, hur, means grapes. Not only that, but there's an implicit understanding that it's actually a raisin. So, enjoy all that wrinkly grape fucking, Muslims. This is your story, not mine.
Just when I thought I couldn't be any more aroused.
Gross. Twisted interpretations of the Quran make some fundy Muslims think that these super-duper sex-tier rewards are only available to them if they're martyrs, and they don't have a problem squaring martyrdom with suicide bombings and the like. Belief in rewards this enticing inform credulous and desperate people's actions, and that's what makes concepts of afterlives and eternal paradises so dangerous.
Just off yourself to fast-track it. A flawless plan.
Well, yeah. I mean, even as we speak, there are fundy Christians who are cheering violent conflict over the new embassy in Jerusalem because they think it goes toward fulfilling end-time prophecy, and they're one step closer to meeting Yahweh. That's fucking bonkers. They actually want all of humanity to be destroyed so they can ride their unicorn down streets of gold to their mansion full of raisins.
This sounds pretty similar to the plot of Infinity War. Okay, not really. I just wanted to make an allusion to it somehow.
Good job. But even if it were similar, how are these people not locked away for posing a danger to themselves and others?
Probably because there are like 3 billion of them and there aren't enough locks.
Okay. So, I think we may all be able to agree that you shouldn't live your life as though you'll be reaping heavenly rewards. Live your life as though your rewards are immediate in the here and now. A smile, a hug, a thank you for your time and effort. Those are the things that count.
Wow. It's like you just channeled your inner grandma and vomited out the cheesiest speech you could muster.
Yeah, did you like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the point is, you can't bank on the afterlife.
But you can bank on fortune cookies, apparently.
Fact. My guest this week is a skeptic, an atheist, a financial guru, and the host of the cleverly named Phil Ferguson Show. He also uses words I don't understand. I'm talking to Phil Ferguson. How are you doing?
I am fantastic, thank you.
I like it when my guests are fantastic. So I wanted to get you on because I have some things that I feel like you could clear up for me. But before we get to that, I wanted, for those unfamiliar with your show, to just kind of get the elevator pitch. What is it that you do?
Well, the short thing about the podcast, the cleverly titled The Phil Ferguson Show, on that show I talk about politics, religion, and money, the three things that you should never talk about in public. That's what I do for a living. I talk about those things in public. My business is Polaris Financial Planning, and I help people get to retirement. I help them invest smartly and keep expenses and taxes as low as possible, so in the long run, they end up with more money. I've been a secular activist for about 13 years. I've been on the board of Secular Student Alliance, Atheist Alliance International, and was recently the treasurer for the Second Reason Rally. And then donate money to different causes, like did a $6,000 fundraiser for American Atheists so they could get 200 brand new members.
Nice. Yeah. Oh, I remember that because you were picking up the membership fees.
Well, American Atheist membership fee is $35, and I wanted to pay for that, but I didn't want people to get it for free because I want them to have some investment. So if you paid $5, I paid the $30 for 200 brand new people. You couldn't be a redo or have a lapsed membership or want to add a year to your term. You had to be a brand new member. So by doing this fundraiser / donating out of my company's pocket, they got 200 new members in 2 months.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's good news. Plus, that's quite the resume you've got there.
It is kind of nice. And the unfortunate thing is I've had many organizations ask me in the last year if I'd like to be on their board, and I'm found that I'm now at the position where my response is that I have a non-trivial number of clients that are employed by, on the board of, or associated with your organization, so to avoid even the appearance of conflict of interest, I'm going to have to decline.
Okay, that totally worked for me.
Yeah.
So when you are trying to help people get to retirement, which is a thing that kind of makes me anxious. I always feel like I'm just going to work until I die. You have to know a lot of really weird words. So what I'm wondering is, how long does it take you to learn that language of finance?
It's one of those funny things, because sometimes I suffer from what's called the imposter syndrome, because I think this is so embarrassingly easy that I'm kind of half ashamed to charge the fee that I'm charging. But people keep telling me, by paying me and in person, that no, actually, I know some stuff that they don't know. So what you can do is, you know, if you studied and wanted to take what's called the Series 65 licensing exam, which is what I have, or you wanted to become a certified financial planner and get their certification, I mean, you could study probably for 6 to 12 months and know all the words and know basics about how investing works. But to really know what to do and things to think of, you know, a couple of years in the industry is really helpful. One of the big problems is that a lot of people that are in the financial services industry, they are salespeople.
Okay.
And they get compensated to sell. They don't get compensated to know what the fuck they're doing. So I just had a listener to the show email me and said, hey, Phil, I've met with this financial advisor and he seems really great. And I've been to their office and it's really nice. And they seem like wonderful people. And they want me to buy this product. You know, what do you think? And I'm like, well, first of all, you use the word product, so I'm scared out of my fucking pants already. Right. And they sent me some details, and it's a fixed/variable annuity, which I've talked about on the show many times, that no matter what you do, under no circumstances, buy that. And the person that's selling that doesn't need to know shit about finance, investment, economics, how businesses work, how the markets work. All they've got to do is convince you to sign a contract. That's their job.
Okay.
And so it can be a very weird thing, because you don't really need to know what I know to make a ton of money in the financial services. You would have to be willing to lie, though. So, you know, there's that.
Right. And so you don't want to just be a salesman that works on just making people buy things.
Right. And the funny thing is, I have to acknowledge that in a way, anything that I do, even being on your show, being on my show, is shamelessly self-promotional, and I'm selling me perhaps as a product. But beyond that, I'm kind of like the unsalesperson, because someone will call. And matter of fact, if your listeners, well, wait, before I say this, how many listeners do you have?
Like two, like me and one other person.
Okay. So anyone that listens to your show, if they send me an email and say, hey, I heard you on this podcast, I will set up a time where they can have 30 minutes of my time unencumbered.
Wow.
There's no expectation. There's no fee. There's no nothing. And sometimes people talk to me and go, you know what, that was all I really needed to get started. And I go, cool, you're on your way. God bless. Good luck to you. It doesn't matter. You don't have to hire me. I definitely, like you said, I don't want to convince anyone to hire me. And anyone that does hire me is free to not pay me at any moment in time. They just say, Phil, I'm out. I've decided you're incompetent. You're an asshole. I'm out. And they're free to go. The last thing I want is someone unhappy to stay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get the impression that you're an incompetent asshole, though.
Well, I mean, about 3 years ago, I had someone where we talked multiple times. I sent them disclosure documents, which I have to do by law. They signed a contract. We opened up new accounts. We moved their money from their old accounts to the new accounts. We made a plan. We massaged the plan. We implemented the plan. We sold everything and put it all in the plan. And when all of it was done and all their money was now in the right place, they called me and they said, Phil, I've decided I'm just not going to pay you.
Oh.
And I remember kind of almost like thinking it was hysterical. And I went and told my wife, and she says, are you going to sue them? I go, no, in my contract, it specifically says at any time you're out. I can do all this work for free and I have nothing to hold over your head. There's no minimum dollar amount. There's no minimum time period that you have to hire me. There's none of that, because if I hire somebody, that's what I want. If for any reason I decide I'm not getting what I thought I was going to get, I don't want to pay them. So I do the same thing. I don't really give a shit if your reason is good or not. If you don't want to pay me, don't fucking pay me. Get the fuck out of my life and don't harsh my mellow. It's all good. But when I talk to other advisors, they say, well, you should put something in there that they have to pay you for a minimum of at least a year or 6 months or at least a certain dollar amount so that you're compensated for your time. Done this 23 years. I have about 250 clients. It's happened once.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to change it. I'm not going to change it. And even if it happened 10 times, I'm not going to change it, because it's what I want to do and it's my business. So I do whatever I want.
Okay. Well, then I want to make sure that I keep that in mind. And what I'll do is, in the show notes, I will link your email address that's on your business card.
And it's fine. And great.
My listeners can get this very, very generous offer from you.
And just keep in mind, I am kind of busy, and I am planning on taking a vacation, so it might be a little bit of while or awkward for me to respond to you in the next few weeks. And if I don't respond to you, email me again. I will not be offended.
All right. Excellent. So do you have any particular episodes for people who don't really know much about investing and saving that may need kind of a primer on what this stuff even is? Do you have a couple of episodes that you put out that you feel are like a best of intro?
Well, the funny thing is, I'd like to tell you, yes, I do, but I cannot do that.
No?
Each show is a random topic that kind of surfaces up in the preceding week or two, so I don't have one of those shows. And sometimes I'll do general things like, this is a stock and how stocks work. And it's really, really lame for people that already know that stuff. And then the next show, I might dig in, like I had an interview with a guy who wrote a book about the Federal Reserve. And for a good part of an hour, we talked about the very specific technical nuances of the Federal Reserve. But I don't have any show where I really kind of lay out the overall plan of what I recommend, because I think it's complicated enough that one show or two wouldn't cover it. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I need to do that. I'll put that on the list of ideas of something I might do in the future. The big problem I have now is that I'm busy enough that I don't put up show notes, and I don't even have a spreadsheet anymore that I keep notes on what were the basic topics that I talked about. So people ask me and I go, I don't know, just, I'm sorry, use Google. I'm really lame. Sorry.
Well, I think what you need to do is just tell everybody that what they have to do is listen to every single episode.
Well, yeah, download them all. Notes. You don't have to listen. Just download them all because that's what counts. But what a few people have asked me to do, and it's something that I might do, is, and if one of your listeners know how this works, let me know. And again, it's phil@polarisfinancialplanning.com. I'm thinking of hiring a service to transcribe all of my podcasts.
Oh, right. Okay.
I haven't looked really hard, but it looks kind of expensive. So, you know, that there's that. But the reason I might do that is I've had a few people ask me to put it all together in a book. And so the book would not be, definitely not like a spy novel or a thriller where you just read through it, but it would be topics one after another where you could randomly look at, you know, I want to look about annuities. Here it is. I want to understand Phil's position on long-term bonds, and they go to that page, and there's, you know, paragraphs or pages on that. And it would definitely be something where I'd have to hire a writer to take what I've said and rough it up, and then we could hash it out together. And of course, they would get full credit for being one of the co-authors, because I suck as a writer. It's not pretty. It's just not
well,
good.
It's
so
not
I can't do it on my own. No, it's not easy, and it's not my skill set. I had a blog that I put in one, two, or three posts a day for 5 or 6 years, and I rose to the level of insignificance. I do the podcast, and I don't know why it's different. It's probably because I'm talking instead of writing. And before, I don't know if you're familiar with this, a lot of the podcast companies changed how they calculated listens. I was getting close to 20,000 a show, and I don't understand that. I don't understand why people listen to my show, why they keep listening to my show, but they do. And people recommend friends all the time. So I'm always humbled and flattered and honored and kind of almost embarrassed that many people, because who's Phil? I mean, I don't know. It's kind of a weird psychological drama going on in my head.
Well, in the circles I run in, there aren't too many people that say, who's Phil? We all know you. You dole out information in an authoritative and pleasant voice, and I think that that's why people listen to you.
Well, you're very kind, and my long involvement, like I said, 13 years in the movement, there are people who know me, which is, that was the motivation for the show being called The Phil Ferguson Show, because I didn't have to build brand value of a podcast name. I just borrowed from my own branding already of people knowing me.
Right. I think that works.
I cheated.
I don't think that's cheating. I think it's just a really good marketing strategy.
Well, someone said Rush Limbaugh uses his name, and I'm like, don't ever say that again.
No, yeah. No, we're not going there.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Well, let's get into our topic, because we're talking about investing and we're talking about long-term strategies. And so I wanted to ask you how you feel about investing in futures.
Well, at first I thought investing in the future, and I would say I'd get back to you because that would be the future. But futures is something that's very complicated, very risky, and it's not something I recommend. As a matter of fact, it's one of the many, many things that I recommend against. I follow the KISS rule, keep it simple, silly, and only invest in what you know. And if you don't know anything, I have book recommendations so you can learn about stocks and bonds and index funds. But fancy stuff like futures, puts and calls, straddles, and many, many other things, I'm not interested in it. I give really, really boring investment advice. I think of myself as the tortoise and the tortoise and the hare
yes.
fable, where you just do certain. So how to money is what I teach people to do. I teach them how to money. The first thing, you must spend less than you make. I know, right? It's comically, ridiculously easy for me to say that. It's harder to do, but you have to do
it
that.
It is.
The second part is what I normally focus on is how to invest wisely and smartly, and futures is not one of them. And then the third thing, it just fucking takes time. When I had someone call me and said, Phil, can you double my money in 1 year? And I said, are you trying to be funny or do you seriously think this is a possibility? And I go, well, I seriously think it's a possibility. And I go, well, then you can't be a client. What? And I go, that's not what I do. I don't know what the fuck fantasy world you live in. And he said, so it's not possible to double my money in a year? And I go, possible? If you want possible, I can double your money in 5 seconds. And he's like, well, how's that? And I go, bet on red, my friend. Go to the roulette wheel and bet on red. If you win, you double your money. It's that easy. He goes, well, I could lose all my money. And I go, that is an additional criteria that was not in the original set.
Right.
So if you just want to be able to possibly double your money, go to a roulette wheel. It will work, or you'll lose 100%. That's how that works. But in investing, it's not how it works. And someone that thinks that's how it works becomes a potentially dangerous client for me because they will be dissatisfied and they're going to blame me. So fuck that. I don't need them around.
Okay, but what if the investment strategy doesn't entail any risk? What if it is a guarantee?
Yeah, see, I don't know what that means.
Okay, well.
A guarantee. Matter of fact, even depending on how you define risk, even having your money under your mattress, there are risks associated with that. Your house could burn down. You could get robbed. Or you have money as cash in a bank making next to nothing or 0.5%, and you might say there's no risk in that. Well, there is risk in that. There's opportunity risk that you could have made more money. There's inflation risk that inflation is going to go up more than your cash, and it becomes worth a smaller and smaller amount as time goes forward. So if you look at everything that's available, I'm not willing to accept until shown otherwise that there is such a thing as an investment without a risk. There's always something, and you need to understand those somethings. And something that you brought up with futures is that futures, depending on how it's structured, futures provide the opportunity for you to lose more than 100% of your investment. If you buy normal stock and a normal bond, your loss is limited to 100%. Now, I found out when I was younger that my dad proved that theory wrong because he bought a stock and it fell and he sold it and it went back up and he bought it again and then it fell and he lost more money than he originally put in. So if you work at it, you can do it. You can lose more money, but normally the most you can lose in stocks and or bonds is 100%. So there's a floor. But with something like futures, especially if you're buying on leverage, you might buy 10-to-1 leverage like corn futures. You can buy $100,000 of corn futures by putting $10,000 down. If those futures fall by 15%, you lose $15,000 and you get a short or a margin call and you've got to come up with $5,000 more. If you cannot come up with it quickly, I mean, it's usually pretty damn quick. You got to come up with this money when you get the call. They will liquidate your position right away, and in your account, you might suddenly show -5 or -6 or -$7,000, and you've got to find that money and pay them back. So you can lose way more than what you invested. That's a kind of risk that I don't want to take.
Okay. So corn futures are a bad idea, but
right.
What
now,
about...
if you had said pork bellies, right? Because everybody loves bacon.
Yeah, but you can only invest in pork bellies if you first bet your brother $1 that you can make somebody a street urchin.
That's right. That's a noble cause right there. It's like, I really think the Bible left out the part of the story where God and the devil bet $1. I think that would make that the perfect movie.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing missing was the dollar.
Exactly. I'm 100% in agreement there that if they had made that $1 bet and made Lot black, I think that would have been perfect.
Well, I mean, isn't that basically the story of Job, though?
Oh, God, I'm so sorry. I did mean to say Job. Lots of totally different piece of bullshit in the Bible. My apologies.
Okay. Well, I mean, Job. Lot got screwed, too, but...
Well, yeah, by his daughters, but... I did mean to say the story of Job where the devil takes his animals and his kids and his wife and never, never, never wavers and turns away from God. And so when it's all over, the devil's like, oh, shucks, I lost this bet. And God goes, no problem. Here's a new woman and here's some new kids and here's some new animals. We're all good. We're square. Peace out, bro.
Right. You get all new property. All of that is property.
Yeah. Yeah, the story with Lot, though, that's magical, where your daughters get you so drunk that apparently you don't know you're fucking them, but yet you're not too drunk to be able to fuck them. That's some skill sets right there. Those daughters were magic.
Yeah, that's pretty good. But yeah, I mean, you know, when we're talking about the story of Job and the righteous people in the Bible, you know, they were investing in futures too. Not corn futures, but crown futures.
Crown futures, the crown. Yeah, it's a prophecy. I was arguing with somebody about biblical prophecy, and they were trying to show me biblical prophecies. And I said, let me ask you one little question. And they're like, yeah, what's that? And I said, the people that wrote the stories in the New Testament, and that's all they are, they're stories. Did they have access to the Old Testament? And they're like, what is that supposed to mean? I mean, if I want to write a story about Batman, can I look at the older episodes of Batman, the older movies and TV shows, and can I incorporate stuff from that when writing my Batman story? And they're like, yeah. I go, same thing, dude.
Yeah, it checks out. I mean, once you get into the New Testament, then you have Jesus walking around talking about this magical place of heaven and how the streets are paved with gold and there's a
room prepared for you.
A room prepared.
In my father's house.
And mansions, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's all great as long as you're not a fucking fig tree, because you're going to get fucked up.
Especially out of season.
Yeah, out of season fig trees. And of course, there was the whole story where Jesus told his disciples to go steal an ass so he could ride it into the city, which I think it was Sunday. So depending on if theft is considered work, they violated possibly two of the Ten Commandments just so he could fulfill prophecy that he obviously knew about. That's why he had them steal the ass.
Right, but he also misinterpreted it because he had to come in riding on two asses.
Yeah.
Because they read it wrong.
It's a wacky thing, just like a young girl, or is it a virgin? And, you know, it's like arguing about how many angels are on the head of a pin or which cryptocurrency is the best. None of it matters because it's all pretend.
Right. So speaking of pretend, what do you make of the promises for your investment? You know, the tithes to the church and your praise and worship of God will, you know, get you a better seat at the table or will get you a better reward in the afterlife. What do you make of all that?
I am at the point where I'm trying to decide what would be a better money-making venture if I completely lost my morals, a church or a hedge fund. I haven't decided, but you know, the idea of giving money to a church. I mean, George Carlin, you know, the creator of the universe and can do anything. He just can't fucking handle money. I mean, are you seriously serious? You're kidding me, right? And talk about conflict of interest when the minister gets the money and he's the one telling you to give the money. It is a waste of your time. It is a waste of your mental power. It is a waste of your precious financial resources. It's just like the lottery. Don't buy lottery tickets. Save the money. Invest it wisely. And eventually, this is the part that freaks out most people, you have to wait. Eventually, you can have more money per year from your investments than you could make working. And that is magical. When I first learned that concept in my teens, I was like, are you fucking kidding me? At some point, my money could make more money than me working. Now that shit's lit.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So what you're saying is giving money to a church is not a good investment.
I would consider that to be slightly worse than lighting it on fire.
Wow, that blows my mind.
No, materially worse than lighting it on fire. Yeah. Because I've got a little bit of a pyro streak in me, and you can get a nice pretty fire burning money, I guess. Not that I would ever do that, but you don't have the negative consequences that are associated with the church. And of course, before some of your listeners say Phil is all anti-religion or anti-Christianity, I will acknowledge that there are good things that happen in churches. I just think that religion is a net negative to our probability of survival as a species.
And I would not disagree with you. I mean, my whole shtick here is let's see if we can make religion go away.
I'm all for it. You know, I don't know that we can make it go away, but I want it to be disreputable enough and small enough that when someone says they have to go to church on Sunday, that they turn red and they're embarrassed that they're going.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like at the atheist convention where Hugh Laurie said that having an atheist conference in Europe is kind of like having a conference for right-handers.
Yeah, I get it. And I want to work myself out of a job. I don't want any harm to come to anyone that follows any religion. I just want them to wise up and not follow that religion. But I will have to admit, there are some atheists that I have met. It's something bigger than a non-trivial amount that believe in some crazy ass shit.
Yes.
So just because you're right, in my opinion, on the topic of God, does not mean that you're right on every topic. And the most predominant one that I've seen, and it makes me really, really deep down sad, I have met atheists that seriously, either that or they're really good trolls, seriously trying to convince me that the earth is flat.
Right.
And I can't.
Right.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, I've had a couple of guests on this show where we've addressed that issue directly, where it's like, you know, just because you got the right answer to one question doesn't mean that you have the answer to all the questions. And there are some outspoken atheists who also are outspoken about some really crazy, weird shit.
Absolutely. So don't give money to a church. That was easy.
Yeah. There you go. I mean, I don't know. I need you to follow me on this because I need help understanding this. This has always just plagued me. I had a conversation with my dad, and he told me that when he tithes regularly to the church, he has enough money for all of his bills and he doesn't really have to worry about anything. But if he stops tithing, then all of a sudden he starts having financial problems. So I'm looking for like the math on that.
Yeah. And what you need to do. Okay. So here's what you do. I got it. And your dad should love this. Your dad going forward will give 10% of his money to you.
Okay. All right. I'm on board.
And then each week he has to rate his financial performance, and randomly you will from time to time give 10% to one church or another without telling him when you're giving money and when you're not giving money. And then you take all those weeks where you did or didn't give money, and then you take all the weeks where he self-reported, which is a chink in the armor, a dent in the armor, and then do a correlation analysis. And odds are you're going to find out that there's no correlation between the weeks that you donated his money and then he didn't. And he'll be so distraught that he'll forget about the fact that you kept the 10% on the other weeks.
Excellent. I feel like this is not only is this a very good use of the scientific method, but this is also a really neat little way for me to make some pocket change.
It is. Now, if you feel guilty about it, which I wouldn't, because, you know, he needs to learn the lesson. And it's a cheap lesson, right? I honestly think he's getting a deal out of this. You could always just give him the money back and say, I never invested any money and you're doing fine. And here's your $5,000 back from the entire year.
Yeah.
Or like you said, just put it in your Roth IRA.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, that's actually a pretty decent, skeptical and scientific way to approach that. And I feel like that's part of the problem with people who are dumping their money into the church is that they aren't thinking about what that money is doing. And it's doing nothing. But, you know, churches don't have the kind of transparency that other charities have, that other organizations have. They don't have to disclose financial reports. And you have people like Joel Osteen and Joyce Meyer here in St. Louis that are just making bank off of their congregations. And the congregations just keep giving them money without any question as to what the hell they're doing with it.
Yeah, it's a really unfortunate situation. If churches should be able to avoid taxes, they should have to comply with the 501c3 regulations just like any other charity does. And they have to document all their sources of income. They have to document their wages and all their expenses. And at the end of the year, they have to report a percentage of the money that they raised that went directly to benefiting the people that they're claiming to benefit. Now, I know a lot of churches, especially if they're well off, like Joel Osteen's church, they probably give a lot of money to people in need, but it's probably 10, 15, 20% of what they bring in.
Right.
I spent several years pretending to be a Missouri Synod Lutheran. That's another long story. And I got access to the books, and there were some years where the church was giving or passing through less than 5% of the revenue that came in because the church had big bills, you know, the roof and the furnace blew, and they have genuine expenses to operate a big building like that, even though they're not paying taxes for the road or the police or the fire or the sewer or the water. They're not paying for any of that shit. They're just mooching off their neighbors, and they don't pay property taxes, again, resulting in everyone else that lives in that city or that community to pay higher property taxes. They're a giant leech on the system, and even with all that leeching, they could only give about 5% of what they brought in to benefit people that are poor.
Right. Well, and
that's staggering.
So the rules around 501c3s, because, you know, other secular charities that aren't churches and just other organizations that are 501c3s have very specific guidelines and very specific rules and the whole, like, you know, not campaigning for people and just that whole bundle of stuff. But what makes churches different where they still have that 501c3 designation, but they don't have to do all of that disclosure and that accounting. And
actually, I'll just jump in real quick here. They may petition for and collect the 501c3 designation, but they don't need it.
Okay.
So they don't even have that designation. They may choose to do so and then ignore the reporting. But normally you just go, I'm a religious organization. I'm exempted by law. I don't have to report shit. And it makes a church really the ultimate money laundering machine. It's amazing.
Right. Well, and that seems like it's just a massive problem with government entanglement and religion. I mean, if somebody says, hey, I'm a church, and they're like, okay, you're good, then that seems like it's explicitly breaking the wall between church and state.
I think so. I think the church should be treated like any other self-proclaimed charitable organization and comply with the laws that we have. But that's not where we are. Also, pretty much anyone that wants to be a 501c3 can't politic or promote certain individuals. And with the elimination of the Johnson Amendment by Mr. Trump, churches are now specifically allowed to politic and raise as much money as they want. So someone could give $1 million to a church with the explicit understanding that $1 million goes to promoting a political candidate, and the church can spend that money. And by definition, by law, you're not breaking any campaign finance laws.
Right.
Because they don't have to comply.
Okay. And so, yeah, so then basically churches just become super PACs.
Become super PACs that have no documentation at all of where the money came from or went to.
Ugh.
So they're ultra PACs.
Ultra mega PACs.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned that you were a fake Lutheran, but I think maybe if you would agree to it at some point, I'd have to bring you back and do a what even is a Lutheran episode.
Well, and of course, it's funny because when I pretended to be a Missouri Synod Lutheran, I did not realize that there was a difference between types of Lutherans. There's at least four that I can think of off the top of my head. There's ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, and they're crazy liberal. They let women talk and vote and shit
what?
In their congregations. Yeah, I know. It's not biblical
women
at all.
Women talking. Next thing you know, they're going to be able to read.
Yeah. Yep. And there's I think it's Missouri Synod, Iowa Synod, or Wisconsin Synod. That's the other one. And they have, the one I was in was Missouri Synod Lutherans. And they were like, well, I'm not saying the earth is 6,000 years old. It might be 10.
That's very generous.
Yeah. Or I talked to one of the science teachers, and she said, well, there's Christian scientists and then there's non-Christian scientists. And I'm like, what the fuck is a Christian scientist? It's like Christian fiction in the bookstore. I don't get it. It's all fiction.
Right.
How does one distinguish some Christian stories as being fiction and some as being factual? They're all stories. There's no evidence to support any of it. And if they say, but they actually found some of the locations mentioned in the Bible. Well, whoop-de-fucking-do, I can find Metropolis on a map. Superman must be real.
Hey, I have actually physically been to Platform 9 3/4.
My son was there and got an awesome picture, but it exists. And that's post-talk. Or was it prophecy?
I'm going with prophecy. Just only for Harry Potter, though.
Well, there actually is one of the main universities, I can't remember if it's Princeton or Yale or something, actually has a Harry Potter church where they will read the book as if they're reading the Bible and talk about how that relates to their life. And they treat it as like a Harry Potter study, the same way people study. And I used scare quotes because we're on the radio, scare quotes, study the Bible, because studying the Bible for most people is reading a couple of lines and having your pastor tell you what it really means. And you go, oh, well, that wasn't clear enough because it was written in original English. I'm glad this guy was here to explain it to me.
Right. Well, I don't understand why they don't read it in the original Klingon.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, speaking of all of this church nonsense and people just throwing money at it, what is your biggest concern about churches in the U.S. when it comes to money?
Well, you added the thing there at the end. I'll give you my biggest concern, then I'll think about the money thing. The biggest concern is that religion perpetuates the idea that you can know something without evidence, that you can take it on faith. And sometimes when people lose their faith, they lose their religion, they decide that they're an atheist, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're a critical thinker and they can still believe other wacky things that just aren't the religion thing. And so you have this incredibly gigantic system that teaches you from a very young age not to question, not to think. Thinking is bad and you just need to take things on faith. That's to me is the single biggest problem with the whole process. But as far as it comes from money, there are a lot of scams that happen in churches, and there's a lot of people who are barely getting by, but still giving 10% of their money. They would be financially much, much better off giving 10% of their money to an index fund. And when I say giving, I'm investing, and they could keep the money and have it grow, and they can have more and more money off over time. So giving a church money really breaks my heart that there's a lot of people, and there's an unfortunate correlation that there's more churches in areas that have average less money. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Right. Well, and I think that that's what I would say is that it seems like the money aspect, the tithing aspect, is something that was pulled out of obscurity to justify just bilking people who can't afford it.
Well, and the thing is that the original idea of tithing is that this person is doing the Lord's work, and so they don't have time to farm and they don't have time to go make money. So you give them a portion of your crops or firstborn calf or your 12-year-old boy, whatever it is, and they don't have to go out and earn it. They can live off of you and then be there for you as a spiritual guide. And it never does say 10%, but it's gotten way out of control. And, you know, you mentioned one of your favorites, Joel Osteen. The fact that this guy has literally hundreds of millions of dollars and there's a Bible scripture that says that a rich man will get into a heaven is just as likely as a camel going through the eye of a needle.
Right.
It's comically bad and people just accept it. And thankfully, that concept, the opulent wealth of ministers, is one of the things that helped my wife out of Christianity. So I guess there's some good to it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if you're willing to see it,
yeah,
well, that's good.
Or able or whatever it happens.
Yeah. I mean, the way I figure it, if you are going to throw 10% of your income to a church and have no guarantee that that church is going to do any good for the community, because I've seen a lot of times churches, they take money from the congregation and then they will do things for the congregation and they'll help people in the church, but that doesn't extend to the community outside. And I'm not saying that every church is like that, but I have definitely seen that. So the way I figure it, if the people who are giving their tithe to the church really want that money to do good, then they should actually just go and give 10% to somebody who needs it directly.
Right. And someone directly, or an actual soup kitchen or a secular food bank where they will literally take 100% of your money and be able to buy food in bulk to feed people. Way more productive use of your money than giving it to a church and having them slice and dice and pay a staff and assistants and update the organ and replace the boiler in a building that is often used a small percentage of the time of the week.
Right. So that's a really good segue into my last question for you. And that is, what is your personal favorite secular organization to give money to?
I guess American Atheists right now, I know that they've had some problems. And I can't really get into that because I know some things that I'm not supposed to know.
Okay.
But some of the other organizations I have done fundraisers for in the past and I may do again on top of American Atheists is Secular Student Alliance. As I said way earlier, I was on the board for about 5 years combined.
Yes.
Love the work that they do. I've also helped raise money with HA Free, Hispanic American Freethinkers.
Okay.
For Puerto Rico, I've given money to Black nonbelievers, a variety of organizations. And it's one of those things that people will listen to my show and they contact me all the time because I do not have a Patreon, and I'm assuming you do.
Yes.
To help offset the cost, which, listeners, if you're listening, go give some money for crap's sake. This shit's not free and easy to do. It takes time, so go give a few bucks. It won't kill you. I don't have a Patreon because my show from the very beginning was shamelessly self-promotional with the expectation that a small percentage of the people that listen will hire me, and it's worked out way better than I could have ever imagined. So if someone talks to me for free, which I offered already in your show, and they feel bad about it, then I can tell them, give to Hispanic American Freethinkers, give to Black Nonbelievers, give to the SSA, give to American Atheists, give to some secular organization. And if you don't really like the secular organizations for whatever reason, give to your local pet shelter. I don't care, but give some money and make a difference. That's more important than sending Phil $5. But I understand you don't have a model to make money off the podcast, so send the money so that he can at least break even on the podcast.
Yeah, there you go. It was kind of a backhanded compliment. Like, I have nothing to offer, so just give me money.
Well, you have the show to offer, and it's one of these things, if you like a podcast, go to Patreon and donate. It doesn't have to be a ton. If all you can squeak by is a dollar a month, do it. But there are listeners to your show that have real money. Go donate, for crap's sake. You like the show? Go donate it so that Jonathan can keep making the show and not only satisfy you, But you never know who else is going to listen to these shows. I once heard at a convention someone saying, don't start a blog, don't start a podcast, don't start a YouTube channel. Find someone that's already doing it and help them. I'm okay if you want to find somebody and help them, but I encourage anybody and everybody to make a show, even if it's for a year or a podcast or anything, because you never know who's going to find it. You never know. Someone could listen to my show and think that this guy is an idiot, and they can listen to Jonathan's show and go, oh my God, I get it. Religion is a scam.
Yeah, but they'll still say I'm an idiot.
Well, as long as they're out of religion, I can live with that.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things that I've been really big on is, you know, getting those voices out there and getting those voices easier to find is, I think, very important. Because when people are doing, you know, some searching and some, you know, for lack of a better term, some soul searching about their beliefs, it's good to have people who are willing to just tell it like it is. Or, you know, and everybody has a different style. So, you know, you can approach it however you want. But I know that I've gotten some feedback from some listeners where they're like, you know what, when you talk to people about their deconversion stories, that really helps me because I can identify with that. And that's really what I'm going for.
And I love those. And we didn't even do mine. And I know we're probably getting pretty long for your show. But next time I come back, we can talk about me being a Missouri Synod Lutheran, all about Bitcoin and how I left religion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you have an open invitation to come back and talk all about your history with religion, since we didn't get to that today.
Well, you're very kind. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
All right. Well, before we go, I want you to be able to just kind of call out some things that are important to you, some places that people can find you, social media or whatever, and we can link those in the show notes for our listeners.
Sure. Probably the best thing, if you want something directly, if you want me to talk to you about your investments, Phil@PolarisFinancialPlanning.com is the email. Send me an email. Sometimes I fall behind, or sometimes I miss an email, and sometimes they go to spam. I'll try to get back to every single person that does that. You can listen to the show on all major podcast players, The Phil Ferguson Show. You can share it with your friends. You can find me and the show on Facebook. I'm also Twitter. The handle there is @SkepticMoney. So, you know, check it out. Come by and say hello. And I do go to a lot of conferences every year. So if someone sees me there, of course, I always welcome them to come up to me and say hello.
Yes. And I can vouch that you are very friendly and inviting and easy to talk to. So I hope that I get to see you at another conference soon as well.
I'm getting the vapors. You're too nice.
Well, I'm nice to all my guests.
There you go.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time and really look forward to talking to you again.
Grazie.
What are you buying?
Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die. Come watch TV.
Teach me.
No.
I can't remember where I put that bag of leftover body. Oh, shit. Hey, everyone. Welcome to my segment of the show.
I did not sign up for cannibalism, son.
Cannibalism? What? Who said anything about cannibalism? Not me. No cannibalism for me today. Ever. Anyway, I hope you're ready to channel your inner hobo, because this week we're talking about Nintendo Labo.
So, what even is Nintendo Hobo?
Labo. Nintendo Labo is a new product line that Nintendo has established for the Nintendo Switch.
I love my Switch. I just beat Mario Odyssey.
Define beat, because I'm still in hardcore completionist mode where I'm trying to get all the power moves.
Well, I took Bowser down, flew away in the Odyssey, and declared victory for Mario Kind with the rest of the gameplay just being a nice bonus.
What a filthy casual.
Right?
Okay, so essentially they provide you with a game and the materials you need to construct interactive objects to play the game with.
And how exactly does this have anything to do with hobos?
Well, the thing is that the materials they provide you to construct your interactive objects are made out of cardboard.
Cardboard packaged in cardboard? It's cardboard inception. This is madness.
Yeah, that's how they should have pitched it. Cardboardception. It's nice. A pretty great idea, honestly, except for the fact that not everything is cardboard.
Oh.
Yeah, some of the mechanical elements of the things that you build are much more conventional.
So, not nuclear, biological, or chemical. Got it.
I hate you so much.
You know, when you say that, I hear, you're the best dad ever.
Yeah, probably because you're deaf as fuck, you old man. Go die already.
What? What was that?
Yeah, exactly. So, basically, you get these sheets of perforated cardboard, and they're all labeled. When you start up the game, you're presented with three main roads: make, play, and discover. Obviously, the first thing you have to do is make the things that you need to play the games with.
So each bundle of cardboard has its own specific game. It's not just like one Labo. Is it Labo or Labo?
Labo.
Oh, it's...
We're not talking about exterior vaginal folds.
It's so it's not just one Labo game that all of the kits use?
That's correct. At least for the kit that I purchased.
Okay.
I ended up getting the variety kit, and it came with five different things to build and play with. An RC car, a fishing rod, a house, a motorbike, and a piano. Now, all of these things are small enough to fit in your lap, mind you.
Seems to me that depends on the size of your lap. Some of us have bigger laps than others. Pardon me while I eat this entire pizza over here in the corner.
Wow, you just couldn't wait to mention pizza again. I think you've got a serious problem, dude.
You've got a problem.
This whole court's got a problem. So the first thing that I built for the sake of introduction was the RC car. Essentially, this is just a little cardboard bug-looking thing with slots in the sides for your Joy-Con controllers. I was a little confused at first because it didn't look like it actually had any functionality, and the capstone for the project was a cardboard quote-unquote antenna that slid into the top of the Nintendo Switch.
I'm still confused.
Okay, but like, when aren't you confused?
Never.
Exactly. So, I was a bit dubious that anything magical would be happening, but when I finished building it, it took me to the play section for the RC car, and the touchscreen display turned into a simple remote control with two buttons, one on the left side and one on the right side of the screen. When you tapped one of the buttons, it vibrated the appropriate Joy-Con controller, and the little cardboard bug rotated in the direction of the vibrations. Holding down both buttons moved it forward in a straight line.
Oh, so independent steering like a tank. Wait, why didn't they make it a tank instead of a Beetle? Hire me, Nintendo, I have ideas.
Yes. Yes, Nintendo. Hire him if you'd like to get halfway through an idea and then get distracted, lose interest, and eat an entire pizza instead.
Yeah, you really know me.
You're damn right I do. So it was pretty cool, actually, and that's when I started to realize what exactly they were going for.
If they're going to start marketing how great the vibrating controllers are, I can think of a much more lucrative market, Nintendo.
Now that's a gaming system I could get behind. And inside.
And on top of...
Up top!
Yeah.
Okay, so I built the fishing rod next.
Lame.
Quit talking about yourself. I have to admit that the way that they designed it is pretty darn cool. I thoroughly enjoyed building it, and it looks and sort of behaves like an actual fishing rod with a rotating reel and retractable pole. The whole thing has a string similar to a shoelace running up it and down into a little box you construct to simulate the ocean upon which the Switch console rests. The string is wound around a spool inside the box, and the spool is suspended with rubber bands to create the sensation of resistance and to reel the string back in when it's pulled out.
Always pull out, kids.
The more you know. Wow. Just wow. So after all of that is built, you slide one of the Joy-Con controllers into the reel to track the rotations, and the other into the base of the rod's handle to track the angle of the rod. The game for that project is a fishing game that's vaguely reminiscent of the fishing mechanics in Animal Crossing, and it's actually quite a lot of fun.
Look, fishing and fun don't really square up for me. It's more like sitting and waiting. Do you have fun waiting? I don't, unless it's an excuse to drink, which, let's face it, is all fishing really is.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Right.
So after that, I decided that I wanted to just jump straight to the main course, the piano. I'm fairly certain that the projects are listed in order of complexity, difficulty, and time required to build them, and this is the last one that's listed. All in all, it took me close to 2.5 hours to fully construct the thing, and once again, I was in awe regarding the way it was designed.
Awe? Really? There's the Taj Mahal and the Great Pyramids, and you're in awe of a cardboard piano? Talk about easily amused.
Okay, I didn't say I was in awe comparatively. Shut your stupid face.
Your stupid face.
Oh, yes. Excellent comeback.
Yeah.
Very well done. So, here's something I didn't know originally. The Joy-Con controllers have infrared sensors in their bases. Up until this point, this wasn't ever really pertinent to me, and I never thought twice about it. And as I was constructing the piano, it was having me put these reflective marker stickers in strategic places all over certain components. Then, finally, when I was done, it had me slot one of the Joy-Con controllers into the back, with the part where the IR beams come out pointing inside at the piano. After that, it finally clicked with me how the whole thing worked, and it was really awesome.
I'm listening.
Each one of the keys is nestled behind a shelf. The backs of the keys have little marker strips on them, and when you press the key, the IR beams from the Joy-Con bounce off of the reflective sticker on the back to the sensor to determine which keys are being pressed. Then the Switch plays the sound. There are marker stickers in a ton of other places too, primarily for sound effect modifications, pitch shifting, and some other stuff that you don't know exists until much later.
Yeah, like the self-destruct button and the cardboard recycling bin.
Yes, precisely that. The Gaminator with a built-in self-destruct button. Nintendo apparently hired on Dr. Doofenshmirtz before they hired you on.
Curse you, Perry the Platypus!
So if that's where it would have stopped, I probably would have felt like it was an adequate amount of content for the price tag, especially because I had only constructed 3 of the 5 things and I was already thoroughly enjoying myself.
You know, I can thoroughly enjoy myself for free with no cardboard, if you know what I'm saying.
But what would you say if I told you that you could have your very own cardboard lover? Nintendo Labo Romance Kit, coming soon to GameStop.
Take my money!
Okay, but I realized that there's an entire third tab I had yet to investigate, the Discover tab. After doing some research, I found out that there's even more stuff you can do to expand on the creations you built and had already been playing around with to make them even cooler.
Like, put them in the freezer?
No, you turn them into a freezer. Technology's come a long way, you know.
Wow.
So, apparently, once you mess around in that tab for long enough, you unlock the ability to program your own games and do crazy stuff with the marker stickers. I can't speak too widely on this subject just yet, because I haven't tried it out as of this moment, but I'm pretty stoked about it. So, like I said, when I first heard about Nintendo Labo, I was pretty dismissive, because I thought it looked kinda dumb, and I didn't like the idea of paying a bunch of money to make things out of cardboard.
Yeah, that's still me.
But after getting to experience it firsthand, I would say that I'm definitely pleased, and I would highly recommend it to anybody who owns a Switch.
Except me, because I'm a grumpy ass old man.
True facts. But I know for a fact that I'll be investing in the robot kit here pretty soon.
Bet. You won't.
Okay, but like, we both know how much expendable income I have.
Actually, I don't know specific numbers. We'll talk about it later.
Oh, okay.
So, on a scale of a USPS flat rate shipping box to the guilt-free murder of 500,000 hamsters, how would you rate Nintendo Labo?
Probably an express overnight shipment of the 500,000 murdered hamsters.
Damn.
Yeah.
All right. Overnight. That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, expendable income, bro.
Okay. I'll take it. I was talking about your income. I'll take that.
Oh, okay.
Now that I did you all a favor and got you some free financial consulting, you're welcome. We can end this episode, but not before I thank our financial advisors, Sojo, part-time patron Russell, Lisa McLean, Holly Vane, the Saratalk podcast, who visited us and had dinner, the Dumb All Over podcast, Brothel Night, Taro Tikkanen, Corey Hill, and Corey Johnston, host of the Brainstorm podcast and the Hardcore Skeptic. A bajillion thanks to all of you. Please remember to leave us a review everywhere reviews are possible, and if you have questions or comments, send us an email to podcast@waywardwillis.com. Intro music was provided by Austin Cologne and used with permission. You can find more of Austin's music linked in the show notes. This podcast is a media production of Willisware LLC. All rights reserved.
This has been The Wayward Willis. If you liked what you just heard and you want more of John and Logan, you can follow us on Twitter @WaywardWillis, Facebook @facebook.com/TheWaywardWillis, or at WillisWeb.com. If you want to help the show and have a few extra dollars, you can donate per episode or per month on Patreon at patreon.com/wayward. We'll be back next week.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.